Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. And we're doing everything we can to help you start realizing that we have to start uniting. Folks, I need to probably go into this more a little later, but I just want to, before we jump into content, I want to say this, that we, the conservatives, are the problems because there are so many among us, organizations, entities, leaders, what have you, that only care about becoming relevant. They only care about their money. They only care about making money. And in some cases, they only care about making sure that you don't get involved in solving the problem. Because when you solve the problem, their ability to make money goes away. Solving the problem kills the goose that lays their golden egg. So we really have to start calling out these organizations. So somehow, sometime in this year, we need to focus a little bit of what we need to do. I've mentioned this before about creating a campaign, I Bet My Life campaign, because we need to be very bold and we need to basically call people out of just how, the level of corruption and the level of, the fact that they are deliberately undermining us. We consider these people our brethren. We consider these people as good, laudable, you know, we praise them because, oh, they're so smart, they've helped us, and they just seem like a, you know, great people, institutions, organizations, and the only thing they care about is keeping us divided, keeping us from uniting. And the day we start casting these out from among us and start all uniting on the principles of full compliance of the Constitution, restoring the true rule of law and restoring the fundamental framework and design of our Constitution, holding every public servant accountable, then we're actually going to see real changes, and there'll be the changes that we desperately need if we're going to save this republic. All that being said, welcome back, Sean. I know I kind of skimmed over a lot, but what I want to do, because this is 400-some pages, and we're not even halfway through yet, but we're getting close. Because once we kind of, jump through some of these things, we'll be jumping more towards the back, and it gets a little bit lighter. But what we've kind of disclosed, and I think in the past conversations that we have had, and what Sean has been reading, has really exposed the idea that the states with slavery have money, more so than the states without. And the states with slavery do not have the ability to defend themselves. And it's literally come out onto the floor to basically say, look, you know, what kind of relationship is this we're having? We have to spill our blood to keep your, wretched society, your wretched institution of slavery intact. This doesn't go well. And so they're now finally facing these things. And again, the two things that kept them from truly getting this Constitution perfect and right was this idea of, getting rid of slavery and becoming the true land of liberty, because the South wanted to maintain, those three states wanted to maintain slavery. And as a matter of fact, welcome back, Sean.
Good to be here, sir. Thank you.
No problem. And so prior to us starting the recording, Sean made a note that there was a vote about slavery, and everybody voted a certain way except for Georgia. And so, Sean pointed that out, and I'm going, yep, Georgia was probably one of the most consistent, because they were very, at a disadvantage because they weren't nearly as rich as the Carolinas. This was based on the design. There were some people that were, but there was a lot more people that were more affluent in the Carolinas due to the size of plantations or due to this, the award of indentured service. The indentured service by the charters of, you know, granting people land after you fulfilled your 7 years of labor. In the Carolinas, you were awarded 100 acres. In Georgia, you were only awarded 10 acres. And the reason for that was, first off, the people that were going there were from the penal colony, or I should say from the penal system of Great Britain. In other words, these were white-collar criminals. You know, people that didn't, you know, do physical harm. They weren't really immoral. They were just guys that were skimming off, stealing, what have you, embezzling. the run-of-the-mill white-collar crime. And so they wanted to make sure that the population density, as a part of the strategy for Britain to kind of protect these northern colonies, they wanted Georgia to have this population density so that they would notice if the Spaniards to the south of them were marching or going towards the north to attack or anything like that. So this was done on twofold. Now, you don't deserve the same that these other people are getting because you're criminals, but, you know, you get these 10 acres and, you know, you're going to have a dense population. Keep your eyes on those Spaniards to the south of you. So that was a kind of a twofold reason why it was designed that way. So anyway, so Georgia being less affluent doesn't mean that somebody couldn't go in and buy up property and, you know, create a large plantation. But for that to be done in a slow process from earning it, having a family, and becoming very successful in what you're doing and making and growing, that, you know, you grow and you grow your plantation, you buy out other people, and you literally, you know, become a franchise where you can start then buying property for your children as you start looking, you know, in the new lands. And technically the new lands were to the west. And that's why slavery was being propagated across the South into Alabama and into Mississippi and into Louisiana and so forth. So anyway, where we left off, folks, is on July 11th. It's towards the end. This is Mr. King, and he's the sixth to the last person speaking. The last person that speaks on July 11th is Mr. Madison. So let's go ahead and pick up where, you know, Mr. King starts talking about this fixed rule of representation and so forth. Go ahead.
Mr. King, being much opposed to fixing numbers as the rule of representation, was particularly so on account of the blacks. He thought the admission of them, along with the whites at all, would excite great discontents among the states having no slaves. He had never said, as to any particular point, that he would in no event acquiesce in and support it, but he would say that if in any case such a declaration was to be made by him, it would be in this. He remarked that in the temporary allotment of representatives made by the committee, the southern states had received more than a number of their white and three-fifths of their black inhabitants entitled them to.
Okay. So Mr. Sherman of Connecticut, Mr. King from Massachusetts, Mr. Sherman from Connecticut, you know, comes in as well. Go ahead.
Mr. Sherman, South Carolina had not more beyond her proportion than New York and New Hampshire, nor either of them more than was necessary in order to avoid fractions or reducing them below their proportion. Georgia had more, but the rapid growth of that state seemed to justify it. In general, the allotment might not be just, but considering all circumstances, he was satisfied with it.
Now, again, and I mentioned this before, that these men didn't have any real capturing of empirical data. They were only seeing at the time what they were perceiving as trends, where when you come to find out, when we get to the actual census and the reconfiguration of Congress, who gets more representatives and who loses, because a couple of states actually lose, that becomes the eye-opener of going, wow, these guys really didn't have a great accurate, but they spoke. I mean, Mr. Sherman is kind of speaking like, you know, he understands. He has definitive knowledge on, you know, the population, migration, and that type of thing. That it, at least it comes across that way, right?
Yes, sir.
So
it sounds like he knows what he's talking about.
Yeah. Okay, so now Mr. Gorham of Massachusetts kind of speaks up. Let's go ahead.
Mr. Gorham supported the propriety of establishing numbers as the rule. He said that in Massachusetts, estimates had been taken in the different towns, and that persons had been curious enough to compare these estimates with the respective numbers of people. And it had been found, even including Boston, that the most exact proportion prevailed between numbers and property. He was aware that there might be some weight in what had fallen from his colleague as to the umbrage which might be taken by the people of the eastern states. But he recollected that when the proposition of Congress for changing the 8th Article of Confederation was before the legislature of Massachusetts, the only difficulty then was to satisfy them that the Negroes ought not to have been counted equally with whites instead of being counted in a ratio of 3/5 only.
Sorry about the pause. I had to get my mic up. Okay, so now they're talking again about this 3/5 compromise. They haven't actually gone through and galvanized this. As a matter of fact, there's still hope that they can actually undo this retaining of slavery. It has not been galvanized. It's not, you know, in the sauce. They haven't, you know, committed to that yet. That doesn't happen until August 22nd. That's when Mason kind of, you know, has his little tirade. Okay, so now Mr. Wilson basically pops in with this comment. Go ahead.
Mr. Wilson did not well see on what principle the admission of blacks in the proportion of 3/5 could be explained. Are they admitted as citizens? Then why are they not admitted on equality with white citizens? Are they admitted as property? Then why is it not property admitted into the computation? These are difficulties, however, which he thought must be overruled by the necessity of compromise. He had some apprehensions also from the tendency of the blending of the blacks with the whites to give disgust to the people of Pennsylvania, as had been intimated by his colleague, Mr. Governor Morris. But he differed from him in thinking numbers of inhabitants so incorrect a measure of wealth. He had seen the western settlements of Pennsylvania, and on a comparison of them with the city of Philadelphia, could discover little other difference than that property was more unequally divided among individuals here than there. Taking the same number in the aggregate in the two situations, he believed there would be little difference in their wealth and ability to contribute to public wants.
Okay, so again, they're kind of arguing, and in so doing, they're exposing, you know, I'll just say what we look at today is this is not good. This, you know, how in some ways they're just dealing with this like, you know, they have no idea. They have no idea how this had the ramifications of maintaining slavery ended up creating all sorts of ways of nefarious, evil people being able to manipulate and utilize, you know, what happened. Because we're talking about the mistreatment, the abuses, and the loss of life and so forth. I mean, these are truly, you know, exposing the business at hand. And this, I think, was one of the reasons why Mason becomes so infuriated. Go ahead with Mr. Governor Morris.
Mr. Governor Morris was compelled to declare himself reduced to the dilemma of doing injustice to the southern states or to human nature, and he must therefore do it to the former. For he could never agree to give such encouragement to the slave trade as would be given by allowing them a representation for their Negroes. And he did not believe those states would ever confederate on terms that would deprive them of that trade.
Okay, so then on the question, they said for agreeing to include 3/5 of the blacks, Massachusetts, no. Connecticut, yes. New Jersey, no. Pennsylvania, no. Delaware, no. Maryland, no. Virginia, yes. North Carolina, yes. South Carolina, no. And Georgia, yes. So that's 6-4. So, in other words, it still wasn't palatable. On the question to taking the census the first year after, yes, no, yes, 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 no, yes, yes, yes. So basically three, is it two no's? Three no's. So that carried. They said, yeah, we do need to get an accurate picture. Maybe they all knew that they didn't know what they were talking about. Anyway, on filling the blank for the periodical sentence, census, with 15 years, it was kind of agreed with no contest. But it ultimately comes down to a 10-year cycle instead of 15-year. Now, Mr. Madison then moved that to change that from 15 to the words at least. In other words, instead of committing to a hard every 15 years, at least every 15 years. So you could do it sooner, but you had to do a census by 15 years. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir.
And so when you look at how that went through, they basically said, nah, we just want to have a fixed number. Let's just have a fixed number. So that didn't get accepted. So now we just go on, and we're going to go down to General Pinckney of South Carolina on Thursday, July 12th. And folks, you'll find this on page 174. And we're getting back into discussing property. Now, when most people think property today, they think about their cars, they think about, you know, their belongings, and they think about their property, their land, real estate, and so forth. And this is, back in those days, it means something completely different. So let's go ahead. Are you there?
Yes, sir.
So let's just jump into what General Pinckney of South Carolina throws out there.
General Pinckney desired that the rule of wealth should be ascertained and not left to the pleasure of the legislature, and that property in slaves should not be exposed to danger under a government instituted for the protection of property. The first clause in the report of the first Graham Committee was postponed.
Mr. Ellsworth of Connecticut then makes a motion, kind of. He moved. So let's go ahead and look at what he wants to do. Go ahead.
Mr. Ellsworth, in order to carry into effect the principle established, moved to add to the last clause adopted by the House the words following, and that the rule of contribution by direct taxation for support of the government of the United States shall be the number of white inhabitants and 3/5 of every other description in the several states, until some other rule that shall more accurately ascertain the wealth of the several states can be devised and adopted by the legislature.
Okay, so they want to play with the 3/5, or at least make it transitory, that they can maybe solidify it down the road, something a little bit more. Mr. Butler of South Carolina then says, he seconded the motion, and that it might be committed so they can move forward. Because if there's some ambiguity, or at least it's playable within the Constitution, not fixed, hard fixed, then they can create an advantage for themselves in growing it, right? Getting a full person instead of just 3/5. So Mr. Randolph of Virginia then says this.
Mr. Randolph was not satisfied with the motion. The danger will be revived that the ingenuity of the legislature may evade or pervert the rule so as to perpetuate the power where it shall be lodged in the first instance. He proposed, in lieu of Mr. Ellsworth's motion, that in order to ascertain the altercation and representation that may be required from time to time by changes in the relative circumstances of the states A census shall be taken within 2 years from the first meeting of the General Legislature of the United States, and once within the term of every year afterwards, of all the inhabitants in the manner and according to the ratio recommended by Congress in their resolution of the 18th day of April, 1783, rating the blacks at 3/5 of their number, and that the legislature of the United States shall arrange the representation accordingly. He urged strenuously that express security ought to be provided for including slaves in the ratio of representation. He lamented that such a species of property existed, but as it did exist, the holders of it would require this security. It was perceived that the design was entertained by some of excluding slaves altogether. The legislature, therefore, ought not to be left at liberty.
Is there something that jumped out here for you?
Yeah, he lamented that such a species of property existed. That's what jumped out to me.
Oh, okay. So not this little, according to the ratio recommended by Congress in their resolution of the 18th day of April, 1783, rating the blacks at 3/5 of their number. So let me ask you this, and you know, I've read this several times, just to be clear. This is the first time that jumped out. In other words, I really thought that the 3/5 rule was a rule that they contrived in a subcommittee or something else. And having read this, like I said, a few times on air, you know, you just kind of think certain things always jump out. And this is why one of the things I have found, the more you read these documents, the more you get out of them. It's just like reading the scriptures. And so the question is, did the framers of the Constitution actually create that 3/5 rule?
I don't know.
No, it says right here, as what you said, basically, let me go into... let's start off with just above that, to the census part, because this is kind of right in the middle of what the paragraph you just read. A census shall be taken within 2 years from the first meeting of the General Legislature of the U.S., and once within the term of every year afterwards, of all the inhabitants in the manner, and according to the ratio recommended by Congress in their resolution of the 18th day of April, 1783, rating the blacks at 3/5 their number. So in other words, Continental Congress, when it was finally ratified, so the Articles of Confederation were finally ratified in March. Now that they had full buy-in, Continental Congress started creating laws and regulating. And apparently, on the 18th day of April, they created this rule of creating a ratio and this idea of census and doing censuses every other year. So in other words, Continental Congress wanted to keep a very accurate picture so that they were constantly shifting. But technically, when you really look, under the Articles of Confederation, representation was based upon, you know, one state, one vote. Didn't matter how many delegates you sent. You could send a bunch of delegates, but you still only had one vote. In this new government, now every representative in the House of Representatives that represents people gets a vote. And in the Senate, both, you know, each state gets two equal votes. So, you know, we see how this is shifting. But the reality is, how many times have we heard people say that the framers of this Constitution in the Constitutional Convention created the ratio of the 3/5 of the black? Does that make sense? Yeah. I mean, this is big because they've been blaming the framers of the Constitution when all they did was they just took the previous... Correct. They literally just carried it over. We're going into break, but to me, this is kind of an epiphany that actually refutes... So it's interesting how we find evidence that actually refutes some of the assertions that make that play on people's emotions to make them hate the Constitution, when this 3/5 rule had nothing to do with the Constitution, but it had everything to do with you know, the problem of the three states maintaining or wanting to maintain slavery. We'll pick this back up right after this promo. We'll be right back.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so, you know, I tell you folks, if you're not getting anything out of this, at least I am. And so, to me, this is big. As a matter of fact, I think, Sean, you pointed out that they were playing with this idea as of 1781, in history. I mean, so it's only when these things kind of jump out. I mean, because when you read over them, if you missed it, you missed it. But there's plenty of other things that are coming out, like the fact of how, you know, he lamented that such a species of property even existed, as you pointed out. I mean, that's something that really, because that's a direct play on our emotions of, you know, how many of these men were looking at this as a very repugnant thing that they were doing and that they wanted to end this altogether. So, and as a matter of fact, as we, you know, kind of look at, you know, the Revolutionary War and how many of the blacks became freemen because they volunteered or they were willing to go fight and take up arms, how they honored that. And yet, you know, I don't think I've heard anything stated how this would be maintaining slavery moving forward. This would literally be a slap in the face of all of these newly freed blacks, right, that would now be able to go vote and they'd be freeholders, what have you, to participate in the system, which ultimately they started understanding the importance of voting and so forth. And one of the things that we discover, and I think I pointed this out in Why Counties Matter Most, that it was in the early 1800s, many of the states that, you know, looked at slavery as repugnant actually were the state, you know, because it was New York was one of them, that was the first states to actually start denying black freemen the right to vote. They were able to vote all the way up to 1800. Then all of a sudden, and I think, so let me ask you this. You know, there's politics in everything, right, Sean?
Absolutely.
Okay, so when they started deciding that blacks, they wanted to actually regulate blacks not being able to vote in New York, why would they want to do that? Because apparently, they were looking or seeing a trend that blacks voted a certain way.
Yeah.
Okay. So let me ask you this. What happened in 1800 that would have caused pause to say, you know what, the blacks are kind of, you know, going down this path of agreeing with this major political shift, right? In 1800, there was a huge political shift, right? We kind of covered this. We covered this with the Alien Sedition Acts, because the Alien Sedition Act is where government actually started becoming, you know, arbitrary and tyrannical, being able to, you know, just make up their own laws where with powers that weren't delegated. So when they looked at the outcome of how you know, a percentage of voters were actually voting for individual liberty and individual sovereignty. They said, hey, if we just take away the black vote. Now, this is all supposition, but I'm telling you, folks, when you start understanding why and how people work, then it becomes really easy to just take, you know, to look at this and all of a sudden connect the dots and go, oh, the blacks must have been voting for true liberty, individual liberty and individual sovereignty, and weren't on board with the big government federalists at the time. And so while New York still had a body of federalists that were literally, you know, trying to grow government in New York, and actually, I don't know if you knew this, because I don't cover this. After Jefferson became president, guess what states had a real pushback against this Republican form of government, this Republican Party, and the shift back to individual liberty, individual sovereignty? Guess what states? Go ahead. If you're saying something, then I'm not getting it through telepathy here, so you just have to say it. In other words, you may be muted. Well, Sean, you're not muted, so I will just go, I'll just lead forward. So, ironically, most people would think that maybe the southern states would not be advocates for individual liberty and individual sovereignty. But believe it or not, they actually were on the side of Jefferson in supporting the dismantling of big government, because they were the ones paying. They were the ones that, you know, were in ways being more effectively costed, or I should say more effectively charged for the cost of government, if that makes sense. But the northern states, i.e. the New England states, were the ones that actually wanted government, because they wanted the cod fishery bounties. They wanted to get, you know, money so that they would be protected in building their navy and doing the things that they thought they, but they wanted government to pay for that. So as we, you know, go through the very beginning of Jefferson's term in, I want to say 1803, forgive me. And actually, if you look it up, you will find that there was a convention in Connecticut of states. It wasn't a full convention of states. They basically called all of the northern or the eastern states to, you know, into a convention to say, you know what, I don't like, they didn't like what Jefferson was doing on the imposts, because it was adversely affecting them. And so they actually had and convened a convention to talk about seceding from the Union. Now, the question is, were you ever privy to the fact that that happened? And so I'm going to guess, because I see Sean there, and I'm not hearing anything from Sean. All right, so Sean, can you hear me now?
Yes, sir.
And we can hear you. Great. We finally worked out something that we couldn't figure out what the problem was. To this day,
self out.
Yes. Yeah, so, folks, for this day, moving forward, we have to blame the NSA or some, you know, entity that is trying to shut down this conversation. So, again, did you know about this convention and this movement that was really actually supporting big government and not supporting individual liberty, where they finally said, you know what, we're going to take the blacks' votes away so that they, you know, don't carry, you know, this anti-federalist or the Republican Party agenda, because we want to get back to the federalist agenda, if that makes sense. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes sense.
Okay, great. So with that, Let's go ahead and pick up where we left off, and that would be with the next comment, Mr. Ellsworth of Connecticut.
Okay. Mr. Ellsworth withdraws his motion and seconds that of Mr. Randolph.
All right. So now all of a sudden, you know, they're going, okay, so that made sense. Mr. Wilson.
Mr. Wilson observed that less umbrage would perhaps be taken against an admission of the slaves into the rule of representation if it should be so expressed as to make them indirectly only an ingredient in the rule by saying that they should enter into the rule of taxation, and as representation was to be according to taxation, the end would be equally attained. He accordingly moved and was seconded so to alter the last clause adopted by the House, that together with the amendment proposed, the whole should read as follows, provided always that the representation ought to be proportioned according to direct taxation, in order to ascertain the alterations in direct taxation which may be required from time to time by the changes in the relative circumstances of the states. Resolved that a census be taken within 2 years from the first meeting of the legislature of the United States, and once within the term of every blank years afterwards, of all the inhabitants of the U.S. in the manner and according to the ratio recommended by the Congress in their resolution of April 18, 1783, and that the legislature of the United States shall proportion the direct taxation accordingly.
Okay, so he didn't include the three-fifths, but he kind of did go down the path of using the same clause that made that. So in other words, it was an inclusion without actually mentioning it. Does that make sense?
Yeah, kind of saying it without saying it.
There you go. Because according to the ratio recommended by Congress in the resolution. So in other words, so that we're not basically putting a spotlight on the fact that we're actually doing this terrible thing of, you know, giving representation to what the South is claiming as property, which they want full representation, but this compromise makes us look bad. Anyway, okay, so now Mr. King of Massachusetts comes up, and this is what he says.
It seems quite ironic that one of the major issues that they broke away from Britain was taxation without representation.
Right.
And now here we are, arguing about the same thing.
Yes, but the one thing that was the foundation of the legitimacy of the one thing was the fact that in Britain they didn't recognize slaves as an apportionment in Britain. It wasn't until, you know, in Continental Congress with the Articles of Confederation that they started doing that. And they started doing that because the Articles of Confederation did not get involved in slavery at all. That was a state issue. So the states that were going to have slavery, okay, so they made an accommodation, obviously, in that resolution of Continental Congress of 1783. Okay, so, all right, Mr.
Well,
King.
I guess my point was that they were upset because the Crown was basically benefiting from their labor, and they weren't even getting representation for it.
Yes, I know. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. So it's that was the point.
No, but you're right, because they were Englishmen. I mean, they were the culture, they were the civilization. Unfortunately, as W. Cleon Skousen and Thomas Sowell and all these experts on slavery have gone out and, you know, kind of helped everybody understand that the application of slavery for producing labor was second nature in society, like putting a belt to hold your pants up today. You never gave it any other thought, like, you know, should I use suspenders? Overalls, you know, having a shirt and pants together. I mean, the way we dress and the things we use to do that, it is not something we give thought to. And back in those days, as blatant as it was, I mean, I can't believe that you wouldn't go a year without seeing several different cases of abuse, where, you know, one human being would be abused by another, a slave owner would abuse their slaves. Now, I do know that there were basically really good men, like, you know, believe it or not, Washington had been lauded for his love for his slaves. As a matter, there was a point in time, forgive me for going down this little side trail, but it's worth mentioning because I think Ron Chernow, in the biography that he did for Washington, pointed out that he had some, Washington had some slaves run away. Washington the man, Washington the general, if you abandoned your duty on the battlefield, he had no hesitation of pulling out his gun and shooting you in the back and killing you. None. That was a duty, you had this responsibility, and so forth. In other words, you were being held accountable, this, your responsibility, you know, that you joined the army to do this. Now, he had slaves, and he had slaves that ran and left. Most people would think, well, then he would probably execute those guys so that it would get out that, you know, he was, you know, a just heavy hand, you know, heavy-handed, but a just man. Okay, but that's not what he did. He went and chased, hunted these slaves down, and he got on his knees and pleaded with them to please come back. I don't know if he got on his knees, but I do know he begged and pleaded because he was helping them understand that if they get caught, because at this point in time, they're not freemen. They have no documents to prove that they are freemen. If they get caught, they can be thrown into any slave, you know, under another master. Please come back. You know I don't abuse you. You know you've got it good with me. Why would you run away other than the fact that you want your freedom? I get that. But the circumstances won't allow that to happen. You will get caught and you're going to be thrown into somebody else's hands. Please come back with me. And he talked them all into coming back. Another thing that he did was, and this is in the biography, that whenever any of his slaves were sick and, you know, beds, you know, the fever, what have you, he got doctors, he brought them in, and he tended to them and nursed them so that they could, you know, come back to, you know, good health, because he treated them like his children. He had no children. That technically they were his children. This was his property when he married Martha, or they were his. And so he really did treat them like family. He cared for them. He loved them. And as a matter of fact, he loved them so much that he made a real critical mistake. He basically put in his will that his slaves would go free when Martha passed, which basically he put out a death warrant on his wife to basically incentivize the slaves that if she dies, then we're free. That was a common mistake that many slave owners were doing, and many women did get killed. What Martha had to do, and ultimately what had to happen, is that the women had to actually let them execute their freedom so that they wouldn't be executed. Does that make sense?
No, but I understand your point.
Okay. Well, so...
I know it's convenient and a 21st century perspective to have, but I would have to say that part of the reason why he did the things he did may not have been so easily explained by he was a good man and he loved his slaves and they were part of his family. I think it's more about property. If you have tools that you count on to make your money, then you're going to take good care of your tools. You don't want your tools to fall in disrepair. You don't want your tools to be lost or stolen because you need those tools to make money. In order to keep his property and his wealth, he needed those slaves. And so he treated them right so that they would do what he wants them to do. And he didn't want them to escape because they would fall in other people's hands and he'd lose his property. I mean, just to take the other side of the position, because I don't understand how somebody can be a devout Christian and not, or just look past or deny, you know, another living being's freedom and agency and still consider yourself to be a good man.
So,
and like I said, that's probably a modern perspective. I didn't live in those times, so I can't look at it and say, oh, this is what he was thinking, or this is why he did this or why he did that. But I'm just saying, from scripture and from a basic foundational Christian perspective, you know, how can you have another person and treat them as property? I think it was more about the value of the property than it was about the value of the human being.
Okay, so let's create a contrast. Because in society, when you become so influential and so affluent that you have this opulent paradigm, if there was anybody in the United States that would have had an opulent paradigm, it would be Washington. He was the richest man. He was the highest holder of land. I mean, he had a city. Mount Vernon was a city of industry. They made his own nails. I mean, he had his own mercantile to where he didn't go buy things from general stores. He made everything for himself. I mean, he had that type of industry going on his estate. Thomas Jefferson was pretty close in those same capacities. I mean, the real, very powerful, large, affluent plantations were like that. So it would have, if Washington was like the Pharaoh, then the slaves were literally just that for him. And, you know, when somebody would come along, because I remember a good metaphor where somebody would basically say, if you went to the Pharaoh and said, hey, you know, if you get rid of your slaves and we start going into technology and so forth, you can have running water. Well, the Pharaoh would go, well, why do I care about running water? I have slaves that bring me hot water, cold water, whatever I want. You know, I got that. So what are you offering me? I already got what you're offering me, because that's the opulent look. Washington, there's no evidence of him actually having that callous or disregard like a Pharaoh who had, you know, basically believed he was God and treated everybody like his, you know, subjects or lesser than. And because Washington didn't have a family, because he didn't have kids, that may have been one of the things that helped, you know, give him a special bond, because these were the human beings that he lived his whole life with. They've been together since he was a young man, inheriting his inheritance from his father, inheriting them and his property and so forth, and then finally marrying Martha, where they kind of put their two estates together. I mean, Martha was pretty well established. She was well-to-do herself, which actually thrusted him into becoming the most powerful man, the most richest man in America at the time. So easily he could have been that kind of man, but one of the things that history actually shows is he could have easily became and stayed and maintained a presidency until he died, but he didn't. He happily stepped down. As a matter of fact, at the end of the war, he could have marched in and said, now I'm taking over. But he didn't do that either. And so he had this level of nobility. As a matter of fact, one of the things that they... back even in their day, and you still hear people say, the best form of government is a noble king, a king that truly loves his subjects and will lay his life down for them. And so that was kind of Washington's paradigm. I think that he was more cast in that than he was, you know, just a callous businessman. Because I do believe that what you state is probably more of the rule of the day. I think Washington was an outlier. There's more evidence that proves that he was an outlier than he was, you know, a truly shrewd, good businessman, just doing, making good business decisions, if that makes sense. I believe it was very common of what you can, your conjecture, but I don't think that was necessarily, there's no evidence that actually kind of lays that out. There's more evidence that he was far more compassionate with his slaves. I mean, I don't even know if he was so compassionate with his animals. But he did, this was like family. He had a love for them. And there was pretty good documentation in the biographies and so forth to capture that. But anyway, for what it's worth, I get it. I completely agree that I think that was the rule of many people because it was just business for them. Kind of like, as I said, it was second nature. Most people just took it for granted because it's like using a belt to hold up your pants. That's how the labor got done. That was just business. And I agree. I completely agree that it was repugnant. Any Christian wouldn't do that. And I think at the point in time, we covered the Washington, the Jefferson's wolf thing, right? We got the wolf by the ears?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so in covering that, I mean, even Jefferson was being very pragmatic. He didn't want to maintain slavery. He, if you go through his biography, he's probably one of the one few men that had very extensive biographies. And Dumas Malone, six book series, really goes in and covers this man. And in so doing, he basically identifies how Jefferson evolved in his paradigm. The concept, the first person that ever uttered the words, "We are all created equal," was Thomas Jefferson in a court case in 1770, fighting to help a mulatto obtain his freedom based on the law. That line, "We were all created equal," became embedded and is the most famous line in the Declaration of Independence. Thomas Jefferson actually had the opinion, and he kind of apologized to people that he argued with, that blacks were capable of being intelligent and so forth, when he started actually experiencing and seeing firsthand this, you know, poetry, mathematics being performed in Philadelphia by free blacks, that he's going, "Oh my gosh, I didn't know blacks were capable of such, you know, cognitive abilities." It was kind of evolutionary, because bottom line, you know, why is it that we perpetuate paradigms via family? Because it's all you know. It's what you were brought up with, and there was nothing really to oppose that. And it's one of the reasons why it took so long to basically start rooting out racism in America, because it was institutionalized by the family, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, these are always good philosophies to talk about. And we won't know the real truth until we get to a point where we can meet face to face, you know, in his presence and have these kind of conversations, you know. But the real question is, will this be so important at that point in time, or will there be other business at hand that will actually prevail, you know, and dominate our focus in doing bigger and better things than the trappings that we had to deal with in this sojourn or this journey? Anyway, we're almost out of time. Any go-backs? Anything else?
No, sir.
Okay. All right. Well, we're leaving off with Mr. King of Massachusetts, so we'll pick that up in our next episode. But down the road, I do want to start getting into some other issues, but I'd like to actually kind of get through the notes on the Constitutional Convention, because as you can see, this is going to take us into April, probably, just to get this finished and then going into the ratification phase. But these are the two most critical documents. I'll try to explain that in the next episode so that we understand in a legal context why these two documents, the notes on the Constitutional Convention by James Madison, as well as the ratification debates, bar none, they are the most important documents we have. That is a legal perspective. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.